Through this whole Advent season, we've been reading in Matthew's Gospel, and today is no different. I'm reading from Matthew 11, verses 2 to 11. When John, that means John the Baptist, when John heard in prison what the Messiah was doing, he sent word by his disciples and said to him, "Are you the one who is to come, or are we to wait for another?" And Jesus answered them, "Go and tell John what you hear and see. The blind receive their sight, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, and the poor have good news brought to them. And blessed is anyone who takes no offense at me." As they went away, Jesus began to speak to the crowds about John. "What did you go out into the wilderness to look at? A reed shaken by the wind? What then did you go out to see? Someone dressed in soft robes? Look, those who wear soft robes are in palaces. What then did you go out to see? A prophet? Yes, I tell you, and more than a prophet. This is the one about whom it is written, 'See, I am sending my messenger ahead of you who will prepare your way before you.' Truly, I tell you, among those born of women, no one has arisen greater than John the Baptist. Yet the least in the kingdom of heaven is greater than he." The context of this passage of scripture is that John the Baptist, who last week, you might remember, was out by the river baptizing people and yelling things at the Pharisees and the Sadducees and anybody else who dared to pretend that they had anything to offer, and he was yelling at them, well, it's landed him in prison. He got the attention of King Herod, and that didn't go well. So now John the Baptist is in prison. He's staring down a violent end to his own life. In just a couple chapters later, we're going to hear about that rather gruesome tale. And he's in prison, and he sends some guys, his own disciples, to ask Jesus, "Are you the one we've been waiting for?" Now, remember that this is the guy who baptized Jesus, who overheard when Jesus came up out of the river, he overheard God's own voice speak to Jesus, "This is my son, the beloved, with whom I am well pleased." How on earth is it that John is now questioning if Jesus is any of that? Is he questioning his own memory? Is he questioning what he thought he knew? He's probably questioning his entire life. Here he is in prison. Here he is. He knows he's not getting out. He knows the likelihood is that he'll die a horrifying death, not just waste away in the prison cell, certainly not be released and die of happy and old age. He knows everything has gone bad. And he's having a moment of doubt. And it's one of my favorite John the Baptist moments, because in that, I find him super relatable. The guy who's wearing camel's cloaks and eating insects and wild honey in the desert, yelling at the Pharisees and Sadducees, calling them brood of vipers, and calling everybody down that they had to repent, I don't really resonate with that John. I think I would have been uncomfortable encountering that John. I don't think I have ever had a feeling in my own life that I was called to a kind of ministry like John was. I did have a friend back when I lived in Simcoe who, she wasn't a Christian, but she always declared that if I ever preached a sermon where I would, at that church we had a big wooden pulpit, where I would bang on the pulpit and declare the dangers of hellfire and brimstone on anybody who didn't believe and get really angry in my preaching, I just had to give her a day's notice and she'd be there because she wanted to see the performance. I don't think I've ever preached a sermon like that. I don't think I've got it in me to preach a sermon like that. So John the Baptist in the river yelling at the brood of vipers who've come to see whatever they've come to see, who think they're kind of hedging their bets, that's not a John the Baptist that I resonate with. This John who's been faithful his whole life, who finds himself in prison, who finds himself wondering, was it worth it? Who finds himself wondering, I think I heard this divine voice from heaven when Jesus came up out of the water, but who knows what was in those locusts and wild honey? Maybe I was wrong. Maybe I was hallucinating. Maybe I got caught up in a movement of something, and maybe it's not really real. He needed this assurance. And so he sent a couple of his friends, a couple of his disciples to Jesus to say, are you the guy? And then Jesus, what I love is that Jesus doesn't go, where's your faith? How do you not believe this? What's going on with him? And cast him aside. Jesus has this incredible, intense compassion for his cousin John. And he says to his disciples this. He says, go tell John what you've seen and heard. Go tell John all the things that you've seen. Go tell him about the blind people who are receiving their sight, the lame people who are now walking, the lepers who are cleansed, the deaf who hear, the dead who are raised, the poor who have the good news brought to them. In other words, tell them that all those things that Isaiah promised hundreds of years ago are now being seen in reality, in the day-to-day lives of the people of Israel, wherever Jesus goes. Now, I don't think many of us have found ourselves exactly in John's position, imprisoned for our faith, staring down the reality of an execution, of being beheaded. But I think that I'm not alone in sometimes needing a little bit of extra assurance that Jesus is who he says he is. That all the things that we say that we believe, all the things that we read in the Bible about who God is and what God has to say, maybe we need a little bit of assurance that that's actually true. When you get overwhelmed by all the worst things in the world, don't you just find that you need a little assurance? God, are you actually good? God, do you actually provide? God, do you actually care about me or about the people I love or that guy sleeping in a sidewalk over a sidewalk grate that I passed this morning or that person over there? Do you actually care? I need just a little bit of assurance because I think I've believed for many years, or it's maybe new, or I had some kind of a divine encounter, but I just in this moment, I just need some assurance. And I love that just as Jesus had compassion on John, he always has compassion on us in those moments. We don't have to hide our doubts from God. We don't have to pretend like everything's fine, like we believe it all. When we don't understand it, when it's not making any sense, when we look at the world and there's a disconnect or there's dissonance between that and all the things we believe that the kingdom of God is supposed to be, it's okay to just go, God, I don't get this. God, where are you in the midst? All of that is okay. Different Sundays this fall, we looked at lament, that kind of pouring out of our sadness or of our anger or of our need for God to show up. We looked at Job, that great suffering man in Scripture. And what does Jesus come back with? He says, go back and tell him, or he says to us, what do you see? What do you hear? Look for where you see me in the world. I was going to bring you all sorts of examples of people and places where maybe we see God at work, but that's your homework this week, because I want you to open up your eyes and just have a look and go, where am I actually seeing that God is showing up in goodness and in faithfulness and in standing up for the oppressed and those things? But just one little hint of where I saw it. We have a member of our church who's often, more often in China than she is here. Many of you know Madeline. Madeline works with an organization called International China Concern. It's an extraordinary organization. In China, some of the least accepted people are children with disabilities, anybody with disabilities, but there aren't so many adults because they usually don't make it to adulthood. In China, there are no resources or anything like that. The organization that Madeline works with, they have homes and care for children with disabilities. And it's a really neat place, and God has provided for them in a country where churches are being shut down and pastors are being imprisoned. This Christian organization works in partnership with local government to provide services and resources that the government can't provide. And that's extraordinary in itself. But in this Sunday of joy, I thought that it was appropriate to, at this point, see their Christmas video. It's just a few minutes, so I invite you, as long as everything's going to work, that we can watch this Christmas video. I can't tell you how many times this week I've watched that video, because it just makes me happy. It gives me joy. And I think what it is that when I read the news or I see all the horrors going on in the world around me, and I'm tempted to question if God's really good, if God really cares, if Jesus actually made a difference at all. This video and the work that ICC does, it reminds me that the way that Jesus is visible in our world is often not in the yelling and the screaming down by the river somewhere, but is in the corners and amongst the invisible people and in the backwaters of places. It's in people like Madeline quietly just giving her life to an organization like this, meaning she spends the bulk of the year in China working with kids who nobody wants. It's the various organizations around the world that are doing things like this. It's the countless churches in a country like Lebanon that has this horrific history of being oppressed by Syrian people, now opening up their doors to Syrian refugees by the millions and feeding them and clothing them and housing them. It's stuff that's not making the papers, that's not getting widespread, which is why I think we can find ourselves in John's position in a prison cell going, is it real? Does any of it really happen? Does it matter? Does it make any kind of a difference in the world? We have to look for it. We have to look for where God is at work and what God is doing. Because here's the thing. Jesus wasn't born into a palace. When he was born, there wasn't all this like political trumpet sounding and going, the next king has been born. All praise, I can't even say the words. But whatever you say when a king is born, he's not paraded out onto a balcony of a great palace. Where was he born? He was born into Bethlehem, a nothing place. In a stable, in a manger. Who greeted him at his birth? Shepherds, nobodies. When we experience the doubts that John experienced, I think Jesus says to us, like he did to John through his disciples, have a look. What do you see? What do you hear? Because if you pay attention, if you focus your eyes, if you open your ears, you'll see that God is still at work. Now, the other thing that Jesus does when he's talking to his disciples, I think just in case anybody was questioning whether John had been a whole mistake, because I think there were other people, too, who now sees this guy, this powerful prophet, this guy who had held everybody to account. Now he's off in a prison cell, and everybody knows what's going to happen to him. Nobody expects him to be freed. And so Jesus goes on to assure them as well, all the people, whoever's surrounding him at this time, to assure them as well that John was this prophet. It's as if Jesus is saying, listen, just because he's in prison doesn't mean he didn't speak the truth. Don't believe the message of those in power and in privileged positions, those empowered and commissioned by the Romans to ensure Israel's quiet acceptance of their reality. Instead, believe John's message, because he was truly a prophet. In fact, he was the prophet that the great prophet Isaiah promised hundreds of years ago. He's the one who Isaiah said, there's going to be one who's going to make a way in the wilderness, who's going to essentially pave the path for the Messiah. Jesus is saying, he is exactly that. You thought he was that when you saw him at the Jordan. He's still that even while he's in prison. Now, this is kind of Matthew's thing. Our best guess with regards to Matthew's gospel, it's an educated assumption. It's not just we're grabbing it out of the air, is that Matthew wrote his gospel primarily for Jewish people. Back in the first century, he was writing with an eye of convincing people who were steeped in Jewish tradition, in the worldview of Judaism, with the kind of eschatological, means the end of the world kind of expectations, that Jesus was the one for whom they'd been waiting. the one toward whom all the prophets of old had been pointing for centuries. This is Matthew's perspective as he writes his gospel. And it's why Matthew's the gospel that if you start at chapter 1, whereas Luke starts with the whole story of the birth of Jesus, Matthew starts his whole story with the genealogy of Jesus. It's right there, Matthew 1, it's gripping reading. And this is the genealogy of Jesus, and then all the names and all the stories and all the people who are included in that. Why? Because he wanted right from the beginning of what he was writing to make it really clear that Jesus is the Messiah that they had been waiting for centuries. And John the Baptist's role in that was as the prophet who would pave the way, who would set the tone, who would set things up for Jesus to enter into. In Isaiah 35, Isaiah wrote, "Be strong, do not fear, here is your God. He will come with vengeance, with terrible recompense. He will come and save you. Then the eyes of the blind shall be opened and the ears of the deaf unstopped. Then the lame shall leap like a deer and the tongue of the speechless sing for joy." When Jesus says to John the Baptist or to his disciples, go say what you've seen and you've heard. You've seen the blind see, the deaf hear, the lame walk, and all and on and on. He's quoting from Isaiah. He's saying, you've seen all of these things, not just crazy miracles, but things that specifically fulfill what Isaiah hundreds of years ago said was going to be the case. Now, did any of this make things better for John in prison? We don't actually know. We don't even know if any of this got back to John. The story doesn't continue from that point. We don't have a story in Matthew where the disciples go back to John and they go, let us tell you what we heard, what we saw. And John goes, oh, that's better. Okay, crisis of faith averted. I'm all in now. We have no idea what went on with John after that. The next time we hear about John is in chapter 14 of Matthew. He's dead and Herod has beheaded him. It's a gruesome, grotesque story. Doesn't make great Christmas Eve reading, but if you need to, you know, if you've got some junior high boys to intrigue, that's kind of the perfect audience for that story. It's a really weird scripture passage, this one, to read on the third Sunday of Advent, the Sunday of joy, isn't it? I mean, sure, there's these assurances that Jesus is who he says he is and is there with his grace in the midst of it all. But really, this is crisis of faith stuff. This is moments before death stuff on Joy Sunday of Advent. I think maybe when we struggle to figure out how on earth a passage like this fits with Advent, it's because we have a bit of a misunderstanding about what joy actually is. Some of you might be familiar with an old movie called Pollyanna. There we go. Pollyanna's a movie from the 1960s, I think 1960. It's a Disney movie based on a book by the same name that was published in about 1913. It's a story of a young orphan girl who goes to live with her aunt and whose infectious goodwill ends up transforming an entire town. It's like the warm, fuzzy story of all warm, fuzzy stories that Disney has ever told. When we call someone a Pollyanna, what we mean is that they're excessively or blindly optimistic to the point of even ignoring harsh realities and truth. There's actually a psychiatric diagnosis called Pollyanna syndrome for people who have no basis in reality or fact whatsoever, who don't take any responsibility for any of the hard things in life, but just kind of go on with everything painted as if it's all flowers and roses. She tells Pollyanna in the movie, she tells a story of one year when it was Christmas and she really, really wanted a doll. But her father, who happened to be a very poor minister, couldn't afford one. So they wrote the missionaries and they asked for a doll. Something got mixed up, and instead of the missionaries sending them a doll, they sent them a pair of crutches. Her father said to her, "Don't let's be gloomy. Let's try to find something to be glad about." And hence the glad game was born. They played it, and after a while, she says she forgot about the doll and all her reasons for being gloomy, and she found a reason to be glad. Now, she's talking to a rather miserable woman who is just completely focused on her own impending death. And the woman says to her, "There's nothing really happy about a pair of crutches." And Pollyanna's response, "We were glad that we didn't have use for them." And that's the glad game. And it's lovely, and it's heartwarming, and it's a fun movie. And if you're looking for some 1960s film, it's one to look at. And yes, there's a point of being thankfulness, and there's a lot that's good in the glad game. But sometimes I think we call joy, or even happiness, something as if it gives us permission to ignore the harsh realities. Like we have to stomp those down so that we can be happy, especially at Christmas, eh? It's like you just have to put on your happy face and not talk about the hard things in life. And it's been a couple months since I had a musical contribution to the sermon, but I couldn't pass this one up. I apologize to those of you who are not Monty Python fans, but you're going to get an introduction. This is a song that is sung in the movie The Life of Brian. And Brian is a man who is being crucified. It's set place in the Roman Empire, and there's a whole group of them being crucified, and they sing this song. Now, I wasn't able to get a video to show that's the actual video clip, so you just have to imagine the dissonance of all these crucified men singing away in this song. So this is a symphony rendition of it. And I do want to apologize. There is a bad word in it. So I'm sorry there's a bad word, but I couldn't block it out. So enjoy. Always look on the bright side. And if you need to sing with it, because you know it and love it, feel free. Here's the thing. It's good advice. Look for the bright things. Look for the glimpses of hope. Look for the places that you see God at work. Like, play the glad game. And when everything's got you down, look for the hints that everything's not as miserable and awful as it is. But let's also be honest. The church especially, Christianity as a whole, has lost countless relevance in our world because that's been the only message we've had. How many funerals have you gone to? How many hospital beds have you sat beside where the message is, well, you just got to find the blessing in all of this. You've just got to find how this is good, because we don't leave any room for everything just to be awful. For us to just sit and recognize that sometimes it hurts. Sometimes life is bad. Sometimes there's injustice and oppression. Sometimes there's illness. There's death. There's suffering and pain. I mean, picture that song, YouTube it when you get home, to picture it with the guys on crucifixes dying, and they do little dances. I don't know how they do that with nails in their hands, but it's this dissonance between the suffering we have and this message of saying there's hope and there's peace and you should be filled with joy. That's always my concern at Christmas and in Advent, and especially the third Sunday of Advent, that it comes off as like, okay, all you people who lost somebody this year, all you people who are sick, all you people who are feeling your loneliness really profoundly right now, you don't get to come to church, because we're all going to be about joy and we're going to be happy and clappy and Pollyanna about the whole thing. And we're going to sing, look on the bright side. And if you dare come in and somebody says, how are you? And you go, actually, everything really sucks right now. You're going to be kicked out of the church because you're bringing it all down. Oh, I tell you, man, the church has a lot to apologize for, don't we? Because that's not the joy that Christmas is. The real joy doesn't deny the fact that the world is in trouble. It doesn't deny the fact that sin has infected everything, that there are bad things happening. Joy, Christmas, doesn't make it like all of that doesn't matter. All of that just goes away. Our joy isn't in the this here and now, and oh, isn't that all lovely right here and now. It's not about denial. It's not about pretending that those things aren't there. Real joy is rooted in knowing that none of those things are the final answer. In John 1, John's gospel, which is one of my favorite of the four gospels, it begins by Jesus saying, that there was darkness in the world. The light came into the world, and the darkness did not overcome it. Every week we light another candle and it gets brighter and brighter. Everywhere you go where people are decorating for Christmas, lights are a key part of it. It's not an accident that we celebrate Christmas at the darkest time of year, when the days are the shortest, when the nights are the longest, and we put lights out and we color it out. What are we proclaiming? We're proclaiming not that, hey, ignore all the dark things in the world. We're saying a time is coming when the light will conquer the darkness for good. That's where our joy sits. Jesus, born into a manger, Jesus who suffered and was persecuted and ultimately died himself on a cross. The darkness could not snuff him out, because that's not the end of the story, is it? The cross isn't where it ends. An empty cross, an empty tomb is where it ends. That's what our joy is rooted in. If you're here this morning and you're hurting, this is the place to be. I'm not here to tell you that you shouldn't be hurting, because Christmas is all merry and happy and good cheer. If somebody sends you a Christmas card or wishes you a Merry Christmas and you want to punch them in the face because you don't want to have a Merry Christmas, there's room for you in the actual Christmas story. There's room for you with John the Baptist in a prison cell going, I don't know if any of this is true. I don't know what to do with this. But I need to see glimpses. I need to see some kind of hope, some kind of a promise that God is actually about bringing his kingdom here on earth as it is in heaven. And so we look at videos like the one that International China Concern produced. And we see these kids who 20 years ago were left at the side of the road to die because they had no value. Kids like the ones that ICC cares for are still being left at the side of the road. But you have people like Madeline and others who go in and live day in and day out with these kids, loving them and just in their presence saying, you have value. And you have municipal governments in a country like China that is saying, we don't have any resources to help these kids. Yes, we will approve your homes, your houses, what you do. And not only that, but we would like you to teach us how to care for these kids. Go and tell what you see me doing, he says to Jesus' disciples, or to John's disciples. Because if you look, you'll see the hints of it. You'll see that there is actually something that God is up to. It's okay if you're grieving this Christmas. Be in the grief. You don't have to look on the bright side. Sure, it's good not to stay in the pit and the darkness and the anger and the violence and all of those kind of things. But there's a number of us in this room who are going to sit down at Christmas Day and somebody's not going to be there who was there. It's okay to be sad about that. It's okay to not feel like you have to go, well, they're better off because they're in heaven. You know what? That's true. They are. But it doesn't make it hurt any less to be here without them, does it? It's possible for the two truths to live side by side, to be sad and to still hold on to that hope and that knowledge and that joy. Because the joy isn't rooted in passing happy moments here, in a dissonance between real life or in a denial or a pretending that the real hard things in life aren't there. It's rooted in knowing that none of those things get the last word. Light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not overcome it. Jesus is the light of the world. That's where our hope is. That's where the peace is. And that's the rooting and foundation of our joy. This is why Christmas is a time of celebration at a time in our calendar when the days are so short and the nights are so long. This is why the angels sang on the night of Jesus' birth. It's why we continue to sing, joy to the world, the Lord is come. Why? So that we can just shut down all the miserable things? No, but so that we can proclaim with song loudly that none of that gets the final word.